Well, we're in Isaiah 30. You can go ahead and turn there. Isaiah chapter 30. That means we're getting close to halfway through the book. There's only 66 chapters in Isaiah, which makes it... Is that number two? I think it is. The book that has the most chapters in it would be Psalms, and then second would be Isaiah. Is that right? Nobody else beats Isaiah because Jeremiah has 52 and Ezekiel's a little bit less. And nothing in the New Testament. So anyway, so that's a lot of chapters. I am having a great time in Isaiah. And I'm waiting for a boring chapter to skip. And it wasn't chapter 30. Now, chapter 30 is a long chapter, but it's not boring. And I hit something. I'm going to not get into it. I plan to not get into it. But I ran into something last night connected to this chapter that kind of caused me to question whether what I've been teaching for how many years, many years, is wrong, including what I taught last weekend at men's retreat.
Oh wow!
Hey, we get to go. We'll have to go back.
I know. We might have to
revisit.
We might have to with
retract.
Yeah. Well, it's not on the most important thing, but it's on a little. It has to do with how faithful was Hezekiah, because if this chapter, Isaiah 30, and also the next chapter 31, 30 and 31 go together, and it's almost kind of like duplicate messages. Like he gave one day to one audience, and then he went to the next day and he gave, you know, a shorter version. But if they're talking to Hezekiah, then it sounds like Hezekiah was not completely faithful. But if you read in Kings and Chronicles make it sound like, you know, the guy did nothing wrong, more or less. He did, you know, there's something wrong later in his life. But I've always believed and taught, and I'm not willing to surrender it so quickly, that that Hezekiah's response to the invasion by the Assyrians was to trust God, and God blessed him. That's what I've always thought. But this chapter, we're going to read it. Well, we're going to study it. I don't know if we're going to read it through at the beginning. Maybe not. But this chapter suggests that maybe before Hezekiah trusted God, he didn't trust God, maybe. Depending on the historical context, you say, why is it so hard? Because the chapter never says Hezekiah. It never says, now King Hezekiah, you better not go to Egypt. It just says, don't go to Egypt. And it talks about the scoffers, and I don't even know if it mentions the officials, but it speaks real generally, or, you know, it's real non-specifically. So for that reason, I can't be sure, and that's not going to be... We're not going to spend the rest of our study trying to figure that out, okay? I'm just kind of putting it off to the side. In fact, I didn't plan to say anything about it because, because I didn't plan to say anything about it, I wrote a paragraph about it at the beginning of your notes. That was on the beginning of page 2. That just kind of summarizes the difficult question. But it's not the most important thing. If we know, and so too, why do I say this? In my opinion, what the Bible doesn't tell us, it's not so critical that we know. Like, if it was so critical that we knew it, then they would have put it there. Mm-hmm. So, now I'd be careful on that, because you say, well, the people at the time, they knew.
Maybe it was important at that time.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing, and here's where it goes for us, is this is applicable by all generations, right? By not putting in there Hezekiah's name, everybody can learn these lessons, and very much us today. So now, and I'll bounce off of that, looking at the title here. I entitled Isaiah 30, The Folly of Trusting Egypt. Now, you say, this is completely irrelevant, and why in the world do I care about Egypt? Because I've never been to Egypt, I'm never going to go to Egypt, and the last thing in the world is I'm going to trust Egypt. So here's the thing. You just substitute in there anything, any other word, except God. Right? The folly of trusting anything but God. Anyone, any idol, any object, any dream. The folly of trusting a counterfeit God. So, and so when we go through there and you're seeing the references to Egypt, then you can see how you apply it yourself. Now the outline here, this is where we're going to, the top, I give you the outline for the book, is the first half of the book anyway, to remind you where we are in the big picture. But the second half of this first page, the outline of Isaiah 30, this is where we're going to be today. Okay, I did not, I do it notes differently every time, sometimes differently, and I didn't incorporate the outline into my notes this time. I just thought we'll spend our morning looking at going through the outline, and it kind of worked out kind of neat. I don't know, I kind of liked the way the outline unfolded, and to me it's real easy to apply this the way the outline here is. But then the notes, you can read those on your own for additional explanation of the passage. Here's what we're going to do. Instead of reading the whole long chapter all at once, like we usually do, and I'm not going to change the pattern, but today, let's just read it by segments. And keeping the outline in front of us to keep our thoughts here on track. So Isaiah 30, and the chapter is broken into two parts. The first part is why it is foolish, and the second part, why it is wise. The first part is focused on the folly of Egypt. The second part is on the wisdom of trusting God. So it's pretty simple that way. It's just a direct contrast. And he gives reasons here. So, five reasons why it's foolish to trust Egypt to save you. And then three reasons why it is wise to trust the Lord. So, it's foolish to trust Egypt to save you because you have rejected God. By trusting Egypt, you're rejecting God. So let me read the first two verses. Woe to the obstinate children. And woe, here, I haven't said too much about it. I'm not going to say too much now, but there's a bunch of woes. Like the beginning of chapter 29 says, woe. And then the middle of chapter 29, 15, woe. And then beginning of chapter 30, woe. And the beginning of chapter 31, woe. And then the beginning of chapter 33, woe. So that's one way to kind of look at this section, is like a series of woes. What's another word for woe? Like,
good is dead.
What's that?
Good is dead.
Yeah, it's like a curse. A curse on. I wonder if there's any other. I wonder if any other modern translations, what they do with that. They don't really.
ESV says, "Ah, stubborn children, declare
some." Yeah, "ah" is another way to go with it. Let me close that door. He's more interesting. You'll start listening to him.
Who is that?
That's good.
He doesn't normally use somebody. He may have the door open.
Woe seems more impactful.
Yeah.
Only if you know what woe means, though.
Well, Shakespeare.
Because kids may think it's like, wow.
It is important to know how it's spelled.
That's true. So it starts off saying, you're in danger if you do this. You're obstinate children, and some of you, right, we've seen this a bunch of times through Isaiah, but you can put yourself sometimes when you're reading Isaiah in the role of the children. And sometimes you can put yourself in the role of God, who has obstinate children. God understands what it's like to have obstinate children. And he says, to those who carry out plans that are not mine. One writer said, I'm not even reading the whole verse, but the essence of faith is to say, as Jesus did when he was at the Garden of Gethsemane, not my will, but thine be done. That kind of captures, in a phrase, the life of faith, of trusting God, as opposed to those who, my plans, not yours, God. They form an alliance, but not by my spirit, keeping sin upon sin, who go down to Egypt without consulting me. And they know, like, if we consult God, he's going to say no. So we're not going to, right? Ever do that? You're like, God, I'm not going to ask you because I know your will. Those who look for help to Pharaoh's protection, to Egypt's shade for refuge. You know, in the background here, you remember that Israel came out of Egypt, right? God delivered them from Egypt. He doesn't need Egypt to help them. They don't need to go be enslaved to Egypt again. I mean, that's really what it constitutes. When you make an alliance and you see here, they're starting to send tribute down there. But you're making Egypt your master. You don't want to do that again. So, by trusting Egypt, by trusting anything else, you're rejecting God, is what Isaiah is saying here. Here's the second point. It is foolish to trust Egypt to save you because Egypt cannot help you. Now, this is just sort of real pragmatic. This is just God saying, look, I can see the big picture. You don't have CNN, but I do. I can tell you that politically, militarily, it's a waste. These guys aren't powerful enough to deliver you. I am. Don't send them your money. Because you're never going to see any return. That begins in verse 3. But Pharaoh's protection will be to your shame. Egypt's shade will bring you disgrace. Though they have officials in zone, these are probably Hebrew Israelite officials, have gone down there to seal the deal, to sign the treaty, to pay the tribute, and their envoys have arrived in Hanes, two cities in Egypt, everyone will be put to shame because of a people useless to them who bring neither help nor advantage, but only shame and disgrace. So God's real clear here. It's waste. There's no ambiguity. There's no like, well, they'll kind of help you a little bit. No, they're not going to help you at all. And by the way, if this does tie into the story of Hezekiah that I was talking to you about before, when this massive Assyrian attack in the year 701 BC, if it does relate, and I'm inclined to think that it does, then historically we know that Egypt didn't help them at all. Mm-hmm. Egypt, they came up, they had a young general, about a 20-year-old guy named Tirhakah. He came up from Egypt and fought one battle against the Assyrians and lost and went back. And it didn't do anything. If that's the same, if it's not the same time, then we don't have any record of Egypt helping them. So, in no case was Egypt, an alliance with Egypt, worthwhile. Now, verse 6, this is strange. I've looked at this in times past because I care about animals. I take pictures of animals in the Negev. This is an oracle concerning the animals in the Negev. And so I'm like, okay, so what's going on here? And like, can I use these verses to help me understand the pictures or vice versa? But it's a little strange. Through a land of hardship and distress, now I'll stop here. What is the Negev? The Negev is the southern part of Israel. The word Negev, it's from the same root as dry, because it's desert. It's basically barren wilderness. Well, yeah, I can see a little more nuanced here. We'll just leave it at that. and that's the area you go through to get to Egypt. So that's the point here. You're going to go through a land of hardship and distress, of lions and lionesses, of adders and darting snakes. The envoys carry their riches on donkeys' backs, their treasures on the humps of camels, to that unprofitable nation. So it's just a picture of a caravan. They're loaded down with all the wealth of Israel going to Egypt through the Negev. And it's just a waste. And it's dangerous. And when it even gets there, here's what's going to happen. They go to Egypt, verse 7, whose help is utterly useless. Therefore I call her Rahab the Do-Nothing. Now that's a little bit strange. Any other translations of that in here? Yes.
Has been exterminated.
Rahab has been exterminated.
Who has been exterminated.
Okay.
Proud one who was silenced.
Proud one who was silenced. Any others? It's a little difficult to know exactly what that phrase means, but there's some things that are... The most important thing is clear, and that is Rahab was like a mythical sea creature. And for some reasons that we don't exactly understand, Isaiah is mocking Egypt. And he's calling her, oh yeah, she's Rahab. But it's not Rahab that's going to... it has nothing to do with the Rahab of Joshua, right? I lost my thought. This great monstrous, Egypt is that, but it's a worthless myth. Yeah, it's a worthless. They're a do nothing. They're a sit still. Rahab the sit still. Or Rahab who has died or has been destroyed. Or it's. I think if we were there in that day, there was some cultural context that we would have enjoyed. We would have been. I don't know if we would have laughed or cried, but we would have understood this better, and it would have made its point. So rationally, logically, so far, it's very clear. You think, okay, Isaiah, I've heard you speak. You're right. I'm gonna change my ways. Right? We're gonna stop this all. There's no sense in doing it. Unfortunately, hard hearts have a way of ignoring truth, logic, and wisdom. That brings us to the third point here. It is foolish to trust Egypt to save you because you have rejected God's prophets. And that's maybe an awkward way of saying you are... By trusting Egypt, you're rejecting God's prophets. And rejecting prophets is never, a good thing to do. Because what is a prophet? I mean, essentially a prophet is God's stand-in. Like, God doesn't, come down and get in your face, but he'll send one of his men to. And I just want to mess with them. And it was different. It's different than, like, a pastor today or a teacher, right? Because... our pastors and teachers are fallible, and we see that, and there's some differences of opinion, differences of interpretation. And I don't stand here and say, thus saith the Lord. But they did. And they were right every time. And if they weren't right, if I'm not right, then I hope you're not going to, pull me out that side door there and throw rocks on me. But if they were wrong, then that's what they were to stone us down. Right, but not...
Yeah, right.
My interpretations are a little more careful. So, here it is, verse 8. Go now... Oh, I like this verse, but... Go now, write it on a tablet for them, inscribe it on a scroll, that for the days to come, it may be an everlasting witness. God's just saying, look, I'm right. I know I'm right. I'm going to write it down, and we come back at the end, and you can say... See, I told you so.
Yeah.
And by the way, Isaiah does this. He doesn't usually say it quite like that, but it's God likes to tell the future through Isaiah and then see it come to pass. In fact, that's going to be I touched on this just briefly at Men's Retreat. In Men's Retreat, some of my messages there tie in a little bit here because Isaiah is contemporary to Hezekiah. And so, but point was, how can God cause his people to be punished, or, I mean, most spectacularly, destroyed and exiled? I mean, how can, because by doing that, as Jeff said in the sermon this morning, by doing that, doesn't God look like the loser? It looks like the Babylonian God stronger, or the Assyrian God stronger. So how does God prove that he's greater? And I think the number one answer, there's probably more answers than just this one, but the number one answer, and especially in Isaiah, is God predicts the future. And by doing so, he says, look, I'm going to allow Babylon to conquer you, but I am going to allow it. I predict it, and it's going to be for a set time, and then I'm going to bring you back. So Babylon should never think like it's, you know, it's because they're greater. Well, so we'll see that when we get into, especially Isaiah chapter 40 and following, which is my favorite part of the book, by the way. Chapter 40 through 48. Well, through 53. And then there's some really good parts after that. All right, so we're on verse 9. These are rebellious people, deceitful children, children unwilling to listen to the Lord's instruction. Okay, we've heard that before, but we haven't heard this as much. Verse 10. They say to the seers, that's another word for prophet, see no more visions. And to the prophets, give us no more visions of what is right. Tell us pleasant things. Prophesy illusions. I mean, isn't this just laughable? But that's what they're doing. Don't tell us the hard truth. Tell us what makes us feel good. What did you say?
Like a lot of churches.
Yeah. Not this church.
No, not.
But you're right. No, that's. People want to feel good, right? You want to pack out a stadium for a Sunday morning. You know, you want to encouraging stories and don't confront. You know, I was thinking about, I shouldn't use names, but I'm so ignorant. I don't really know what. But I was just thinking about this one big church in Houston, where that gets, I don't know, tens of thousands of people. Mm-hmm. And I've never been there, and I've never heard the preacher, pastor, speak a sermon, and I haven't read any of his books. Don't plan to. But I just think, if he was doing God's work, and there's how many thousands of people, I don't know what percentage of population that is, shouldn't that like be reflected in the life of that city? I mean, shouldn't there be fewer... Yeah, you name it. You know, the manifestations of sin. You know, whether it's the bars or the adult stores or. So I don't know. I'm not gonna say I don't those people in that church or, but if it's for real, then I think it's gonna be manifest in daily life, but. So verse 11 just continues a thought. They say, leave it, leave this way, get off this path, stop confronting us with the Holy One of Israel. That's what Isaiah's been doing there. Stop it. We don't want to hear anymore. We want to go our own way. We want to serve Egypt. We want to ally with Egypt. Oh, and by the way, you know, it's kind of important here. It's not like this is a simple situation. Right? It's easy, I think, sometimes you... just kind of look back and, you know, well, you stupid people, you should just... if this is what I think it is, and even if it's not, it's pretty close to the 701 invasion. We're talking about the superpower of the world, and Judah is not good friends. They're not getting along now. They've rebelled. They're not paying the tribute. And so Assyria is going to come and, you know, marching down, and they've got a massive army. I don't know how big it is, but I know that 185,000 of them died, and that wasn't all of them. So they've got the best military hardware. They've got the most brutal style of warfare. Do you want to face that alone? I mean, do you want to just say, well, let's not partner up with Egypt? I mean, isn't there some wisdom in getting somebody with you so that together you can maybe have some hope of survival? Because if it's little Judah, right, Judah's little. Judah's smaller than the Dallas metro, not even the Fort Worth part, but just... Yeah, no, from the north side, from Jerusalem down to Hebron is 20 miles, and you go down to Beersheba, that's 40 miles. So how far is it from, like, McKinney to what's on the other side? Yeah, I mean, that's Judah, and it wasn't this populated. I mean, it was it's rugged and hills, and yes.
And how far would Judah be from Egypt, or at least from where the Egyptians lived?
Where most of the Egyptians live is hours of driving, so you know, like probably 5 hours drive. Mm. So
300 miles.
Yeah.
How about Assyria? Assyria is what? Right there, or
no? Assyria's a lot farther. Assyria is.
But they're big, and they you know they're coming, right?
Right. Mm. Right.
Do they have 185,000 people in Judah? I mean, is it just one division of the Assyrian army?
Yeah, I don't know that we know the numbers, but we know this. It's very clear from in 2 Kings 18:19 that Judah's scared.
Yeah,
and I don't think there's any reason to not be. Well, the reason to not there is one reason to not be scared, only one reason, but all the other reasons mean be afraid. So I think it's good to just kind of remember that. Not because to the degree that we just kind of put them off to the side and say, well, they're just silly and selfish or what, I mean, they're facing death. So can you trust God, you know, when the stakes are so high? Yes.
Todd, I'm just thinking maybe we could look at this as maybe not Hezekiah participated in this, but it's certainly a large part of his advising staff that's bought into this.
Right.
So this is temptation. But when it comes down to it, Isaiah's warning, he makes a decision to put the letter in front of the Lord, right, when it comes.
That's right.
So when all the temptation that hits our lives, that's not going to be the thing we get judged on. It's going to be what we do when we have to make that choice, because that temptation is going to be there.
Right. I agree. There might also be smaller decisions that Hezekiah took before that one. And I'm not sure. That's where I'm not sure. But even in our lives, there oftentimes we're not just one big decision, but it's little
right,
things
right.
we're making before then. And, I entirely agree that it could be a case of Hezekiah versus his advisors, because Hezekiah is never condemned. So now we are on verse 12. Therefore, this is what the Holy One of Israel says. That's funny, I didn't notice this before. They say, stop confronting us with the Holy One of Israel. So he says, this is what the Holy One of Israel says. Because you've rejected this message, relied on oppression, and depended on deceit. That's not good. You've done these things, you know it's coming. This sin will become for you like a high wall. I like his word pictures. Like a high wall, cracked and bulging, that collapses suddenly. In an instant, it will break in pieces like pottery. I thought about bringing in a pot, just like smashing it on the ground. And if I was teaching like sixth grade, I probably would have done that. But you can picture, shattered so mercilessly that among its pieces not a fragment will be found for taking coals from a hearth or scooping water out of a cistern. I mean, normally a pot will break, and this is see this all over in Israel. And they had the pot, that's, you know, used them all. And they would break, you know, kid would trip over and, you know, crash or whatever. And but the pot sherds are still all over. And you can just pick them up off the ground, any of these ancient sites, because they're just gazillions of them. And some of them are, you know, big, and they use them for writing letters. Actually, some of the best letters that we have from the Old Testament time are letters written on these potsherds and other different things. And Isaiah is saying, I mean, you're going to be so shattered that there won't be anything useful. Now, here's an idea, and I didn't have time to pursue it, but just I'll throw it out to you, and you might chomp on it later on today or tomorrow. But this sin will become for you like a high wall. So the idea is that your sin becomes your judgment. What you trust in becomes your oppressor. Now, verse 15. This is what the Sovereign Lord, the Holy One of Israel, says. Here it is again, in your face. Oh, and my two favorite verses in this chapter are 15 and 18. Okay, so here's 15. In repentance and rest is your salvation. In quietness and trust is your strength. Okay, so this is the contrast with everything up to this point in the chapter so far. You know, all of the rushing around, bustling, oh, we've got to send our envoys down there and get the tribute and all of this. And Isaiah is saying, you need to repent and you need to just trust God. God can deliver you and God will deliver you. That's a good one to memorize. The first part, the part then it says, but you would have none of it. So he's saying, this is what you should have done. You refused to do it. You said, no, we will flee on horses. And it doesn't, I think you could think, you know, one possibility here is, well, when the enemy comes, we're just going to run away and we'll get away safely. I don't think that's probably it. I think the idea is we're going to flee on horses down to Egypt to get their help. You said we will ride off on swift horses. Well, God's going to chase you your pursuers are going to be even faster than you. Verse 17 is a reversal of a blessing in Leviticus, where God had said, you're going to go into the land and 1,000 are going to flee in front of you. You know, you'll have one guy and 1,000 will run away. And then there's the other way. The bad guys are going to have one guy come and 1,000 of you are going to flee. At the threat of 5, you will all flee away till you are left like a flagstaff on a mountaintop, like a banner on a hill. That's not good. That means that's all that's left. You used to have, you know, that'd be, you know, Dallas, you know. All that's going to be left is one bus station, bus stop. You know, it's like, you're going to have, there'll be something, but it's going to be a shadow of what used to be. It's like, there was one place, maybe in Isaiah 5 or something, where you're like going to be a hut in a field. Maybe that's Isaiah 1. It's a little shack. Yeah, 1:8. You're going to be like a shack in a field of melons. But verse 18, yet the Lord waits. I think the best translation there is waits. Yet the Lord waits to be gracious to you. You ever think about God is waiting? God waits for his people. He waits for them to repent. They should be waiting on him, but he's waiting on them. He's waiting on us. If we're not waiting on him, he's waiting on us. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's going to one day be saved, right? Because at some point, he's going to stop waiting. And if you haven't repented, then you will be judged. And that, you know, we see that here coming up in verse 27. But He rises to show you compassion, for the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all who wait for him. And I thought I'd been moving along quickly, but the clock says I haven't. So, but that clock, somebody makes that clock fast. So they think they can get out early. I know how that is. I used to do that to my teachers. Okay, O people of Zion, you who live in Jerusalem. This is where we turn the corner here. So now in your outline, see here. It is wise to trust the Lord. Here's three reasons. And all of these, you can just apply them to your life. Because, number one, verses 19 through 22. It's wise to trust the Lord because he will lead you in righteousness. This is what he's waiting to do. He's waiting so that he can teach you. Now, it says how gracious he will be when you cry for help. But you know what? You have to cry for help. To him, not to Egypt. You have to seek him. As soon as he hears, he will answer you. Although the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. Now stop right there. Did you hear that? Although the Lord gives you the bread of affliction. I mean, some people think that it just happened. Like, it's not from God. God didn't have anything to do with it. God was crying too. Well, I say God can cry. I think God can give you the bread of affliction and cry. But, and I don't want to get into a debate. I don't know that there would be any debate here or not. But I think it's just important to put this into the discussion. It says here, the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. But your teachers will be hidden no more. With your own eyes you will see them. Now the word teachers here may be better translated as a singular. Your teacher, because the verb is actually a singular verb. And so this could be a reference to God himself. God is going to teach his people. And I like this picture here. You remember it's in Deuteronomy, right? It says, do not turn to the right or to the left, right? You just stay on the straight path. And here, whether you turn to the right or to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, no, keep going straight. Stay on. This is the way. Walk in it. Then you will defile your idols. Your idols have been defiling you. But now you're going to defile your idols, overlaid with silver and images covered with gold. You will throw them away like a menstrual cloth and say, away with you. You will not have any desire for them. Now, the next section here begins in verse 23. It's wise to trust the Lord because he can provide all your needs. And Egypt's not going to provide your needs, but God will. And I think, too, the way this is an invitation to them, saying, look, trust God and he'll do it. But it's also a prophecy, because one day God will do this. He will send you rain. For the seed you sow in the ground and the food that comes from the land will be rich and plentiful. In that day your cattle will graze in broad meadows. The oxen and donkeys that work the soil will eat fodder and mash spread out with fork and shovel. In the day of great slaughter, when the towers fall, streams of water will flow on every high mountain and every lofty hill. That's you know, you can relate to that if you're from Texas, right? I mean, they have water just everywhere, like a water park. Water is life. And then, verse 26, maybe a little bit hard to understand here at first. The moon will shine like the sun, and the sunlight will be seven times brighter, like the light of seven full days, when the Lord binds up the bruises of his people and heals the wounds he inflicted. Now, if you think of that, if you take that literally, like, okay, the sun's seven times brighter and the moon's like the sun, it's going to be really hot. But I think the sense, I mean, it's in the context of blessing. So I think the idea is, I mean, how do you get crops to grow really well? A lot of water and a lot of sun. Like, the best place in Israel today for crops to grow is in the Jordan Valley, 1,000 feet below sea level. It wasn't so good in the ancient times, but now they've got irrigation. So because it's 1,000 feet below sea level, it gets a lot of, it's always warm down there. I mean, in the dead of winter, it's 70 degrees. It's great. So their crops are ripe. I don't know if it's March or, but it's just way early, and they can do several cycles and get a lot of sun, a lot of water. I think that's a sense here. It's just God's going to pour out his blessing. He's going to heal his people, And then, verse 27 is, why should you trust the Lord? Because he's going to destroy your enemies. And that's true for us too. Now, I have to just read this here. I can't say too much. See, the name of the Lord comes from afar. This is a picture of God coming in great majesty. It's a powerful image. The name of the Lord comes from afar with burning anger and dense clouds of smoke. His lips are full of wrath, and his tongue is a consuming fire. His breath is like a rushing torrent rising up to the neck. He shakes the nations in a sieve of destruction. He places in the jaws of the peoples a bit that leads them astray. And you will sing as on the night you celebrate a holy festival. Your hearts will rejoice as when people go up with flutes to the mountain of the Lord of the Rock of Israel. Why are the people so happy? Because God's defeated their enemies. Verse 30. The Lord will cause men to hear his majestic voice, and he will make them see his arm coming down with raging anger and consuming fire, with cloudburst, thunderstorm, and hail. I mean, why would you ever trust Egypt instead of this God? Right? I mean, this God is so much greater than any other deliverer. And then he speaks real specifically to this situation and to the specific enemy. The voice of the Lord will shatter Assyria. Okay, so you're so worried about Assyria, they're nothing. With his scepter he will strike them down. Every stroke the Lord lays on them with his punishing rod will be to the music of tambourines and harps as he fights them in battle with the blows of his arm. Tophet has long been prepared. It has been made ready for the king. Its fire pit has been made deep and wide with an abundance of fire and wood. The breath of the Lord, like a stream of burning sulfur, sets it ablaze. What's this mean? I think the picture here is God comes, he fights the enemies, defeats them, and then they are punished. Verse 33. It reads to me very similar to Revelation 19. Revelation 19, Jesus comes, sword out of his mouth, this glorious appearance. He fights the enemies. Actually, it doesn't say much about the battle. You ever kind of like, well, what's the battle like when God comes? It never tells us much. It just wins. He doesn't. There's a good quote in your notes there, but he just. Like, there's no contest. So it's not like it's like this close drama, 15 rounds. Do they do that in boxing, or what is it? Like, you know, 9 innings, or whatever it is. Like, mm-hmm.
It's 15 rounds boxing.
Yeah, yeah.
9 innings.
No, it's not close. And then in Revelation 19, it just kind of jumps from Jesus comes, and the enemy is thrown into the pit of fire. And that's what this is here. It's a pit of fire. Tophet was, we don't know much about it, but we know that it was a place in the Hinnom Valley on the edge of Jerusalem where Hezekiah's father and then some other kings later sacrificed their children in the fire. So to pagan gods. So that becomes the symbol. The idols, and those who worship idols, are going to be punished in the place where idol worship had been. The abominable idol worship had taken place. Okay, so it's 12:01. Any last questions? Is that too fast? Let's pray. Father, it's good to read these descriptions of who you are, what your coming is going to be like, your power, your majesty, your might. That there's no one comparable to you, and it's just foolish to hedge our bets. It's foolish to make an alliance on the side because maybe you won't come through or something. That's just Isaiah just makes it so clear how silly and wicked that is. Help us to apply that, Lord. There's just been a more just this straight teaching, but not necessarily thinking about how it needs to work through my life or the lives of all of those here. So pray that you'll work these words into our thinking, and that we will be conscious of things in our lives which tempt us to trust them instead of you, that we will put our trust wholly in you, that we'll be willing to do risky things, radical things, because you are fully trustworthy. We ask this in Jesus' name.
Thank you very much, Todd. Ladies, remember, baby shower at our house today at 3:00.